The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Green Front. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg, and happy to be with you today and happy to be bringing you a little bit of good news compared to the panic we were all feeling about a week ago, certainly a long way from the stabilization of the disaster. Of course, I'm talking about what has been unfolding in Japan since March 11th, but there has been a little bit of progress in terms of restoring power to those damaged nuclear reactors. Last week we had someone talking about how the threat from the nuclear radioactive cloud was not as great as some might have feared, and she was a little bit comforting. I'm talking about Gwyneth Cravens, who wrote the book The Truth About Nuclear Energy, Power to Save the World, and it was an unusual response. I thought, you know, I might call my friends at Positions for Social Responsibility or any number of environmental activists who have been very concerned, as I have, about the safety issues of nuclear power, not to mention just all the resources involved and all the finances that go into building and maintaining these sources of energy production. But I decided to go for something a little bit different, and that was to get someone who had been an opponent of nuclear power, had gotten so concerned about climate change, I'm talking about Gwyneth Cravens, that she changed her position and became an advocate for nuclear power as an energy source, wrote a book about it, and so she was still not, you know, changed in her view that nuclear power is a good response. And there have been others who have said that, gee, considering that the reactor sustained a 9.0 earthquake, monster quake, followed by the tsunami, shows that actually it's safer perhaps than some had thought. But now I want to check in with my friends at Positions for Social Responsibility and see what they think. They have been very active and vocal in trying to warn the world about, you know, what we're taking on. So my first guest will be Alan Lockwood. He is with Positions for Social Responsibility, a member of the board, in fact. And then in our second half, we're going to talk to Matthew Stein. He's the author of a book called When Technology Fails. The book is not even published yet. It just is in galley's form. He was kind enough to send a PDF file for me, and you're not going to want to miss what he has to say, because as we know, technology does fail. Human error is alive and well. And, of course, we had a perfect storm in terms of the disaster unfolding still in Japan with the huge quake followed by the tsunami, followed by the nuclear reactor near meltdown. So welcome to the Green Front, Dr. Alan Lockwood.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks
Happy
so much
be
for
here.
Being with me. I know it was very short notice, but I have been trying to get one. You guys are also busy giving interviews, as well you should be. So I really appreciate you making time for us at the Green Front and on the Progressive Radio Network and for our listeners. First, I want to just get your sense. You probably have been watching things more closely than perhaps the rest of us the last couple of days. We've kind of turned our attention to Libya, kind of catching our breath. Many of us here, I'm speaking to you from the West Coast, there was predictions that we were going to get an earthquake perhaps because of the Ring of Fire, that we were the fourth corner and, you know, just a matter of time. And there's a window between now and March 26 where at least one geologist who predicted the 1989 quake is saying we're still due for a big, significant quake. So the good news is it got many of us to get out the emergency, you know, preparedness kits from the garage and dust off the water and canned food and make some replacements and get some new batteries for the flashlights. But the reality is, of course, disaster can strike at any time. But what happened in Japan March 11th really was kind of worst-case scenario times three. So first of all, what's your sense of the latest going on inside the nuclear reactor? And then we'll talk about the fallout and current threats to human health, and then why we should take another look at nuclear power as a viable source, just as it was beginning to win some favor, at least in this country, even among some environmentalists.
As you said, it's very good news that electrical power has been restored to the reactors in Japan, because that gives the workers there a badly needed resource that they need to combat the disaster that they're facing there.
And overall, do you think that we – well, first of all, it's mostly Japan's crisis, but there have been Americans who are concerned that the fallout nuclear radioactive fallout is going to impact us. Of course, there's been some contamination found in food there, in leafy green vegetables and milk primarily, obviously two, you know, basics in anyone's healthy diet. So what should we be looking at next?
The most important thing to remember, I think, in thinking about these exposures that are occurring to a large portion of the Japanese people is that there is no level of radiation that is demonstrably safe. Even the very small amounts of radiation that people are experiencing as a result of this power plant disaster are a source of some public health concern. Now, the concern is not large enough to set off a panic by any means, but it is appropriate that people are taking prudent steps to prevent radiation exposures. And that includes such things as not eating spinach or chrysanthemum leaves, or in some cases, feeding public water supplies to infants and children.
That's right. When they're seeing contamination in the water supply, that is of concern. Is it still, do you think, at a level where they can or they should not drink it, in your estimation, even if Japanese officials are saying it is okay to consume?
Well, the latest advisories that I've heard concern very small amounts of iodine-131 that have been detected in the water supply in Tokyo that have led public health officials there to recommend that infants and children not drink that public water supply. They're saying that it's okay to bathe in and for older people to consume that water, but not infants and children. And they're at special risk because their thyroid glands are very active during this period of rapid growth and development.
Sure. There's a lot of people, though, in between the infant stage and the senior citizen status, so I wonder what they're being advised or what they're doing.
Well, radiation is not good for anybody, and one of the fundamental principles of radiation safety for radiation workers is that radiation exposures level should be as low as reasonably achievable. There's an acronym for that, ALERA, which stands for as low as reasonably achievable. And one of the things that you can do to protect yourself from the very small risk of radiation that's posed by the spinach and iodine-131 and other commodities is to not consume them until an appropriate period of time has elapsed and the iodine is either diluted or decays back down to closer to background levels.
Okay, let's just take a sort of a step back and looking down from above. Is this in fact a worst case scenario? Obviously, worse would be if there was a complete meltdown. Are they past the point where that could happen, or is that still a possibility?
You know, I don't want to try to look into a crystal ball and predict what might happen in the future, but certainly the disaster at Chernobyl was far worse than the problems that the Japanese have been facing, which are bad enough. But they're still in Ukraine. There are still areas that are uninhabited and had to be essentially permanently evacuated because of the very high amounts of long-lived radionuclides that were spewed forth when that reactor blew up. That's much closer to a worst-case scenario. I guess an even worst-case scenario would be if something like that happened to a very large population center.
I guess the question I would have for you is, are you surprised by what has happened in Japan, both the partial failure of the reactors, so many of them, and perhaps that it so far isn't worse, or is this exactly the kind of worst-case scenario PSR has been, you know, warning about since your position has been, you know, against nuclear power as a viable, safe alternative, so long as I've been aware of you? This may be the reason you came into existence. Is Helen Caldicott your founder?
Well, Helen was instrumental in the resurgence of PSR that took place in the early 1980s and late 70s, but she's not one of the original founders that dates back to our founding about 50 years ago. This is our 50th anniversary.
Well, a heck of a way to celebrate, huh, or observe it. Joking aside, of course, because we are talking about extremely serious matters, back then, I imagine the main concern was prevention of nuclear war.
Exactly.
Was it foreseen back then that nuclear power would be in our midst, in our energy menu, if you will?
Probably to some extent, but the problems with nuclear power, from our perspective, are several fold, and we're seeing one example of that with this disaster that's taking place even as we're speaking. But there's also a very clear link between nuclear power production and the nuclear weapons cycle. The source of plutonium that goes into so many bombs is derived from nuclear reactors. Plus, the problem of what to do with the spent nuclear fuel from reactors has never been solved properly, and we're slowly and steadily, maybe rapidly and steadily, increasing the amount of spent fuel rods at various locations throughout the world in response to the fact that we just have not solved that problem.
And, in fact, it's turning out to be part of the problem, big part of the problem in Japan.
It's a big part of the problem in Japan, and it's a potential source of concern here in the United States. Every single one of the reactors that's functioning at the present time has a substantial amount of radioactive material stored on site in these pools or otherwise stored because there's no central repository that's been determined to be a safe place to store this fuel.
And then there's the threat of terrorists somehow getting this into their hands. So I guess this is not the worst-case scenario, but it is probably one of the worst combinations of natural disaster events combining. Would you agree?
It's certainly bad enough, and in many ways this is typical of many disasters in that it's the result of a whole series of events that each one of which had a relatively small chance of occurring. The chance of having a 9.0 Richter scale earthquake is not very high. The risk of having a tsunami is not very high. The risk of some loss of power at a nuclear power plant is not very high, but all those things happened, and the fact that they happened in sequence and all at the same time is what led to the problem that we're facing now.
And what about the nuclear reactors in our country that are already, in operation, some of them being on or near earthquake faults? What were they thinking back then, because earthquakes are not a recent phenomenon, and how concerned are you that especially some have wondered or put forth a possibility, the theory that with climate change getting worse, we will see more earthquakes, perhaps more intense earthquakes. There's controversy about that because obviously a quake that's 9.0 on the Richter scale, pretty deep down there, and that the thinking being that if we have melting permafrost and some shifting of the plates, that would be, at a more surface level. If I'm taking a layman's approach to that, forgive me, but there's this fact that, there were, up until recently, building reactors, certainly in California, on or near, significant fault lines.
Well,
obviously, that's the fault of someone, pun intended, I guess, but not meaning to make light of it.
Well, if you look at Google Earth and go to the Diablo Canyon reactor site, you can see that just like the reactors in Japan, it's built right on the coast of the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
Now, they thought that one was earthquake-proof and tsunami-proof when they built it, as did the designers of the Japanese reactors.
And now that we know how crucial water, cool water, and abundant availability of that is to the cooling process in worst-case scenario, can understand why they are building it on, the ocean. But again, with ocean combined with earthquake faults is a recipe for disaster, as we're seeing.
Well, so, certainly a potential recipe for disaster and one that we are quite concerned about.
In fact, so concerned that you are, I think, calling the Physicians for Social Responsibility for a moratorium, I would imagine. On, is that just future plant production and construction, or some kind of shutting down right now on all nuclear reactors in operation in this country?
The only reactor that's not going to have an accident where you can guarantee that there won't be an accident is the reactor that's never built.
Well stated. So what are you calling for? What are you saying should happen now? Now that we have seen a combination of, perfect storm, of the intense earthquake followed by, deadly, scary tsunami, followed by partial nuclear destruction?
Well, there certainly ought to be at least, at the very least, a moratorium on the construction of new reactors. And, you know, even before this disaster, there was a great deal of hesitation on the part of Wall Street to finance nuclear reactors. They're always more expensive to build and take longer to build than the architects and planners envision, even though they think they've made adequate allowances for those factors. So if we were to build reactors, and I'm definitely not in favor of that, they're going to be horrendously expensive, much more expensive than any other source of electrical energy.
What do you think of President Obama? He certainly seemed, when he was elected, to understand the very real threats of not only climate change, but that we're approaching, if we haven't passed peak oil, the need, as he said in the wake of the BP oil disaster, to make this, you know, transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy sources. And yet he has allocated you know, millions of dollars to be spent on the development of more nuclear power sources. Where do you think he stands now?
Well, he's probably hiding behind the rubric of reassessing the situation. I mean, the political will to go ahead and build more reactors in the United States is almost surely going to fade substantially as a result of this, at least the will on the part of the public as a whole. There will always be people who are very enthusiastic about the construction of reactors, but it's going to be increasingly difficult to find someone who's willing to have one of these potentially dangerous industrial sites in their backyard. It is true that nuclear reactors don't produce carbon dioxide and contribute to global warming, but there are much safer, effective, and less expensive ways of producing energy than by nuclear power.
In light of the BP disaster and prior to that, the coal mine explosion, which I think took some 24 lives, we've almost forgotten about that one. It's almost a perfect storm of, you know, disaster, worst-case scenario, you know, occurring to, you know, three primary sources of our energy, being coal, oil, and now nuclear. Can we scale up sufficiently with renewables other than nuclear? What's your sense of that? Because we're finding that there's no quick, simple, safe solutions, and our energy needs, not only in this country but, of course, globally, are only going to continue to grow. What is the answer?
Well, the only long-term answer is to increasingly rely on safe, renewable sources of energy and take better advantage of the enormous amount of energy that's deposited on the surface of the Earth every day by the sun, that's generated by winds, tides, wave action. We've only begun to tap those resources, and in my estimation, that's where we should be putting our research dollars, funding the development of these kinds of clean, safe, renewable sources of energy.
Well, if ever there was a time to call for an Apollo-like project, you know, something to really get all, you know, government and corporate and public resources, you know, put into scaling up geothermal, solar, wind power, this would be the moment. And yet we're not really seeing that. We're hearing, you know, the usual corners calling for that, environmental activists, scientists, physicians for social responsibility, you know, I would say the credible corners without any, you know, investments at stake other than, you know, the future safety of life on the planet, and meaning not stock in Exxon or some other, you know, special interest.
The political tide is so strong in terms of favoring tax cuts and reducing the size of government, but this is exactly what government should be doing to protect the health and welfare of the American population. The investments and the stimuli and the tax credits that are necessary for safe renewable energy sources can only come from the federal government. No other entity is large enough or well-funded enough to be able to take on this critical task. And if you look to the future beyond the next election cycle or the next news cycle and think about where my children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren are going to be living and how they're going to be living, it's going to be essential that we be able to develop those safe, renewable sources of energy and have the will as a people as a government to make the kinds of investments that are going to be necessary to achieve that end.
If this isn't a wake-up call, heaven forbid, you know, what might it take? Again, not just this disaster in Japan, but what's happened, you know, what happened over the summer with this oil kill, as I've called it, since it, you know, pretty much killed everything in its path, and wake tourism still suffering, and lots of fallout from that. We don't hear about it as much. But the fallout from this, I mean, literally and figuratively, is going to be felt for, you know, months, if not years, to come. And yet we're, you know, a nation of short attention spans, you know, Americans. And, you know, if it's not in the headlines, at least it's not Charlie Sheen off the front pages in the nightly programs. Like, I'm trying to find a silver lining in this otherwise dark cloud. But apparently he's now sold out. He's planning to go on tour live. So let's not get started on that. But
isn't,
you know,
that nice?
But I guess I bring that up really in part with a serious element in mind, and that is, you know, Americans are so good at escaping, and, you know, reality TV shows that are, you know, about rich housewives and not about, you know, how are we going to supply our energy needs, you know, going forward. This is my pet peeve, my professional quest. There's still not one live green talk show on anywhere in mainstream, you know, airwaves, talking radio and television. And then we wonder why, you know, the American public is putting climate change, you know, lower down on their list of priorities when we have, you know, 95% of all talk shows dominated by, not to politicize this, but it has been politicized somehow, our planet and the future of it, you know, with the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannitys and those who would mock environmentalists and even scientists and doctors saying, you know, there's a greedy side agenda. It's outrageous. And then something like this happens where it seems Mother Nature is screaming at us to pay attention, and yet it still doesn't quite feel like we're in emergency mode, and we are saying we must scale up the safer renewable energy alternatives. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying, what do you think it will take? Do you think your request or demand for a moratorium on new nuclear reactors will be heard, will be heeded? You know, and since when don't we believe physicians and scientists anyway? You know, really quite a loud and sad statement about the state of things in this country politically, when we have, you know, Tea Partiers and others who don't believe climate change is real saying, you know, we need to stop big government spending, and yet not a lot of solutions being offered, you know, in its place.
Yeah, you can say the Earth is flat, but that doesn't make it so. You can make a law that says that we're not going to pay any attention to discharges of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere because it's not contributing to global warming, but that doesn't make that so either. You're right. You're absolutely right. This is the time when the American public and indeed the public around the world needs to be increasingly aware of exactly what it is that we're doing to this planet. You know, my father was a bacteriologist, and one of the lessons that I learned at his knee was that if you put a bunch of bacteria on a petri dish, they grow like crazy and they thrive and they multiply and they do very well, until the amount of toxins that they produce makes it impossible for them to continue to live and multiply. And so they start dying. The question is, are people smarter than bacteria? Are we going to be able to grasp the problems and use the brains that we've been given to work in a constructive manner to solve these difficult problems that you point out?
And what I call the dinosaurs, they kind of seem like a bacteria. I mean, they're multiplying, and they're taking over. And they're taking over common sense. And, you know, physicians for social responsibility, you know, you're trying to, as you say on your website, I like this, prevent what we cannot cure. I mean, just the half-life of, you know, plutonium and this nuclear threat. This is not one of those, you know, quick, you know, emergencies that's going to pass. The fallout, you know, to health, you know, not to mention just political, is going to be felt for a long time. If you were in charge, what would you make happen, you physicians for social responsibility? Because I think we should listen to physicians and scientists who don't have an axe to grind other than perhaps the, you know, health of their children, grandchildren, and generations beyond.
Well, we would have a very broad agenda that would include a moratorium on nuclear power plants and also very aggressive steps to stop global warming. We just can't continue to burn coal, particularly coal, and other fossil fuels at the rate that we are burning them at the present time. Otherwise, we're going to reach a point of no return in terms of global climate change and global warming, and there's going to be multiple disasters that will slowly creep up on us. We'll see more Hurricane Katrinas. We'll see more floods, proliferation of tropical diseases, crops that used to grow in one area of the country that don't grow there anymore because it's too hot, deaths due to heat waves. These are all problems that almost certainly will follow as a consequence of global warming. And yet we have, as you refer to them, the dinosaurs that are blocking effective action to solve these important public health problems.
The fossil fools. And you know, it's one thing to kind of joke about it, because if we don't laugh, we'll cry. And I'm sure you, like I and many other listeners, have had a few moments of just deep sorrow and concern for our Japanese brothers and sisters, and realizing, you know, we're not immune at all. And
yes,
especially here in California, where we are very prone to serious earthquakes, overdue for one, and have, you know, our own nuclear reactors, and some of them, you know, near faults. And yet this is a national problem. This is a global problem. This is a huge challenge. I guess what really bothers me when it comes down to it is it just doesn't feel like we're all in this emergency. You know, it still feels like we're having to fight, you know, these ridiculous, you know, accusations dismissing, you know, that climate change is real, for one. And until we realize the consequences of, you know, realize, connect the dots between what's causing climate change, and you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see what too much CO2 in the atmosphere is doing to our fragile ecosystem and climate and weather, so we can get on with the solutions. But we're still arguing, you know, there's still arguments being made, ridiculous, about, you know, whether it's real or not. And I'm having them in my, you know, very progressive community of Marin County. You know, ran into a friend of mine, and we got into a shouting match because he was, you know, saying, even if climate change is real, there's nothing we can do about it. And this is the kind of person who otherwise is a real take-charge kind of guy, retired early, you know, from Wall Street because made a lot of money, has three children. I won't mention any names, but I was just shocked that someone otherwise intelligent can be in such denial about the kind of future that we're creating for our children with, for whatever reason, you know, I don't know, whatever stocks he has, how can that be a stronger pull than, you know, concern for will there be enough, you know, clean food, water, stable climate, you know, for his children to thrive as we did growing up without these concerns, or a different set of concerns. But these somehow feel more dire, because at least the threat of nuclear war, we could identify that and in some way not wrap our arms around it, bad pun, but just, you know, it was one issue, right, we could focus on. These, as you say, are connected issues, and there is that domino effect. And we don't know, you know, when the Earth is going to snap back, but it seems like she might be starting to.
Yep. And we're dealing with a deadly combination of ignorance, greed, and psychic numbing. It's just, for some people, too painful to be able to contemplate doing the kinds of things that are necessary to prevent the what some of us are thinking is an impending climate catastrophe.
And yet, look at the pain caused just by the intense storms around this country. You know, the 100-year floods that are happening, you know, in Nashville, Tennessee last year, the Midwest, you know, the snowpocalypse, you know, the blizzasters, you know, when they get all this snow and then they mock environmentalists, you know, global warming, ha, ha, ha. And yet that is the prevailing, you know, voices. These are the prevailing voices, you know, on American media today. And it's so damaging and so dangerous to keep us stuck back there in that ridiculous argument, and yet somebody's got to stop this, you know, because we need to all be in the solution, not still debating whether there's a problem, because we have so many problems. So I guess just to wrap up, you know, to my friends of whom I was just speaking, one of being one of them, well, you know, over the years they've said what you're doing is fine, but people won't pay attention until there's a crisis. And even back then I could quickly identify, you know, count them on two hands, all the many global crisis, you know, disappearing species, you know, human sperm count going down, you know, oceans being threatened. That was before the days of, you know, really being aware of how climate change is the mother of all, you know, environmental challenges and the great exacerbator. You know, this is multiple crises, and it seems like we're kind of going into deeper denial. It's like people don't get it, and they don't want to get it when things are kind of okay, and we have the relative luxury of time and, you know, ability to converse intelligently about these challenges. People aren't paying attention then. We go into disaster, and the people go into, you know, freeze mode and paralysis. You know, what is it going to take?
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. Denial is not just a big river in Egypt, and it's important for us to be able to come to grips with some of these really critical issues, because if we don't, the lives of our children and grandchildren are going to be much, much more difficult than ours. There are already hundreds of thousands of people dying every year around the world because of the effects of global warming that are already here. This isn't something that's going to happen in the future. It's happening right now.
I couldn't agree more, and well said, and thank you again for being with us to share the Physicians for Social Responsibility view. I am not surprised to hear it. I am relieved to hear you are resolute and committed to calling for some kind of moratorium, you know, an opportunity to use this, what's happened, as a chance to step back and really analyze, you know, what is the reality about nuclear power, dangers, human error, worst-case scenarios, and let's think twice or thrice before we go ahead and permit any more to be licensed. And thank you again, Dr. Alan Lockwood, board member of a very esteemed, highly regarded Physicians for Social Responsibility. Physicians and scientists should be listened to. Hopefully you'll be able to go to Capitol Hill and testify soon in the wake of this and you know, raise the volume on your concerns.
Thank you very much for having me.
We'll have you back perhaps a few months down the road and see what we can talk about that has happened since this disaster, since it is still unfolding. But again, thanks for being with us. And stay with us right after the break. We're going to have a very perfect segue. We'll be speaking with Matthew Stein. He is the author of a book called When Technology Fails, A Manual for Self-Reliance, Sustainability, and Surviving the Long Emergency. I think it has arrived. Be right back. I'm Betsy Rosenberg.